Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, what's up, everyone? I recently attended the AWS reInvent conference in Las Vegas, and I'm excited to share a few of my many interesting conversations from that event here on the podcast this week. Before we dive in, I'd like to thank our friends at Capital One for sponsoring our reInvent series. Capital One has been a huge friend and supporter of this podcast for some time now, and I'm looking forward to sharing my interview with Dave Castillo, Capital One's Managing VP of Machine Learning, with you on Thursday. Dave and I discussed the unique approach being taken at the company's Center for Machine Learning, as well as some of the interesting AI use cases being developed at the bank and the platform they're building to support their ML and AI efforts. To learn more about Capital One's machine learning and AI efforts and research, visit CapitalOne.com/tech/explore. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone, we are here at reInvent in Las Vegas, and I am with Dave Castillo. Dave is the Managing Vice President for Machine Learning at Capital One. Dave, welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast.
Oh, thanks, Sam. Happy to be here.
Let's just jump right in and talk a little bit about your background. Tell us about your work in the machine learning field.
Absolutely. So I'm actually very fortunate. I got to start machine learning way back when it was still handcrafted knowledge, and we were really focused on knowledge representation. So I started out in the NASA days. I did a lot of work for NASA, and it was about solving problems that were very theoretical, but never really saw the light of day in a production setting.
And which I went NASA.
I worked with all the NASA bureaus, but okay. I was stationed actually in Florida, NASA at the Kennedy Space Center, Johnson Space Center, and JPL, Jet Propulsion Lab. So I worked with all those three.
Okay.
And it was a lot of fun. We did robotic vision systems, which are obviously a whole different technology set back then than convolutional neural nets have annihilated all of that work and put up a lot of people out of work in the process. But started there and really watched the transition go from knowledge representation into statistical learning, into machine learning, into deep learning, and then explainability on top of that. And then more recently, just really looking into how do we do large scale graph related machine learning with graph machine learning. So I've had this very diverse career. I've had two startups, wound up in the media industry as a CTO of an advertising company in New York City for several years. And I left that in 2015 and joined banking with a company called Early Warning, most popular for Zelle, the faster payment system. And I ran machine learning there, the innovation labs, and their data transformation. That company is owned by the seven largest banks in the U.S., including Capital One. That's how I got familiar with Capital One. Okay. And I started here last June in 2018.
Right. So what's your role at Capital One?
I run what's called the Center for Machine Learning, and it's a fairly large organization. It's 200 plus people focused on a center of excellence. And I can get into a little bit more of what that means later if you like.
Yeah. I spoke to Adam Wenchel on the podcast about a year and a half ago, and he went off to do a startup, I think now. Is that the same? Are you in the same role?
I'm in the same role. Absolutely. Actually, I've met Adam, and I thank Adam for the incredible job he did in amassing great talent to sort of incubate the Center for Machine Learning. And Adam had to start in a place where he was really the skill set and the expertise around machine learning. And so the machine learning opportunities and solutions all came in and fanned into Adam's organization. And that's no longer the case now. We've been able to transform that where we can scale it, and we've federated a lot of capability out. So our model is more of a model of enablement now. Mm-hmm. Where we actually join teams, we provide skill sets, technology, platforms, tools, education, boot camps, basically just trying to empower the other teams to be self-sufficient. And we stay with them for a period of time, and then we extract ourselves.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm seeing
all over the enterprise landscape. That's happening right now is this kind of transition from doing machine learning in kind of a lab type of environment, doing a lot of experimentation to, and alongside that, you know, selling it across the enterprise. And now it seems like everyone's bought in, everyone wants to figure out how to do it, how to build models, get their pet model into production. And it's causing shifts in the way organizations are organizing it to support that. It sounds like you're going through a similar transition.
Yeah, so 18 months ago, we had a lot of side-of-desk bespoke initiatives where people were creating their own solutions. They were very narrow, solved very narrow use cases, and they had to go through all the pain associated with getting something from a proof of concept into whether it be a challenger model or ultimately into production. And what's happened since then is that we've become highly collaborative because we understand the challenges associated with getting a machine learning into production in a well-managed, compliant way. And that's not an easy task, especially when you have a material model, a model that's under regulatory scrutiny. Mm-hmm. And even our immaterial models, which are not so heavily scrutinized, but still require, you know, a well-managed discipline about them. Anyway, there was a sentiment about how do we actually take all these learnings and come together as an enterprise and leverage what each other has done and throw away some of these, you know, side of desk solutions that don't scale and really look toward more of an enterprise offering. And we've done a lot of work in that area. So now we have collaboration. Center for Machine Learning collaborates with all the lines of business. We're driving a enterprise, what we call the enterprise machine learning ecosystem now. Mm-hmm. It's driven by myself and another guy named Annie Gupta, who's in our card business. And underneath that initiative, we have our feature platform, our machine learning platform, and our monitoring platform, all really looking at how do you go from inception to deployment and then keep the 360 moving through monitoring and refit and retraining. So there's been a huge sort of awakening that has happened in Capital One. It's really exciting to see everyone coming together. You know, it's not so territorial anymore. It's really, how do we help each other actually get to the finish line?
Awesome. Before we dig into a little bit of the platform that you've built, can we talk a little bit about the use cases? I, you know, have spoken to folks at Capital One that are doing things like fraud and AML, and there are, you know, a bunch of things that are kind of obvious ones for a financial services company. You know, maybe we can talk about, you know, the broad landscape, but I'm also curious if you can share any ones that are, you know, maybe less obvious or more interesting or that you're personally excited about.
Within Capital One, we are looking at applying machine learning across every facet of our business. And we've done some very, very cool and interesting things that you wouldn't think it would be associated with a bank. So, for example, when you join Capital One, you get assigned access privileges to data and to systems. That's all done by machine learning today.
And meaning as an employee?
As an employee. Huh. When you join, and that's something that we built. So that's in production, and it's actually compressed the time for associates to get up to speed and actually be productive because they've had to wait weeks and weeks and weeks to get access to certain data, to certain systems, you know, and now it's all assigned based on these algorithms. That's kind of cool. We have space allocation that happens when we look at how badges are navigating through our buildings, and we can look at how to plan space for people. And that's an interesting application of machine learning. We did one last year where we're assigning our first year associates, they go on a rotation. So the next job is an assignment that's actually a recommendation engine that's actually made by a machine learning algorithm for that job assignment. That was all done manually on a huge spreadsheet. It was very painful for people to do that across the board. That's all automated. And we're doing, you know, what I used to do in the ad tech industry. We're doing AdWord bidding with multi-armed bandits. We're doing creative and personalization, aspiring toward getting granular and personalization with multi-armed bandits. So a little bit of, you know, tiny bit of reinforcement learning. So those are sort of not typical of banking,
yeah.
You know, but I think it's a testimony of that, you know, we're serious about where we want to apply this technology. And there's a plethora of other examples I could give you on document reading documents from our vendors and extracting, you know, salient information out of those documents, et cetera.
The thing that jumped out to me about a couple of those examples, the space planning and the employee example, the onboarding example, is that, you know, the functions that own those processes are HR and facilities, probably not right. necessarily the most, you know, technology forward or, you know, AI enabled organizations. So how do they come to you with those opportunities and ideas, or is this part of the COE process where you're already embedded with them? How does the ideation process work there?
Yeah, it was really an outward reach on our part. And then once we started to educate on as to what was possible, then dialogue started happening within these non-technical organizations. And then something was born out of that. So yeah, it was an outreach. We started up a year ago what we call Advanced ML within the Center for Machine Learning. This is a new group that is focused on three things. One is we had to get better about managing our university research partnerships, and we can talk about that a little bit later. The second item was we wanted to initiate an advocacy function where we could talk to our lines of businesses about what we were doing and how we might look at doing their jobs a little bit differently with machine learning, not necessarily automating the tasks that they're doing, but thinking about their jobs differently. Mm. The third component of that was really focused on getting a collaboration across Capital One on what are the challenges that we're all facing when it comes to machine learning, whether it is at the beginning of the machine learning lifecycle or at the end. You know, let's identify what those challenges are, and then let's look at trying to come together as an organization rather than as individual fiefdoms to solve them.
Yeah, it strikes me that, you know, when thinking about the types of examples that you gave, that, you know, there have to be so many examples like that. But there are also, you know, these kind of very high value, you know, core to financial services types of use cases that, you know, I guess I'm trying to formulate a question around how do you prioritize when you've got, you know, this broad, you know, portfolio of opportunities, you know, some of which are kind of core to the business and, you know, drive, you know, revenue and profitability, and others are, you know, supporting organizations that, you know, aren't necessarily central to that conversation or are not often central to that conversation. Again, the HR facilities, that kind of thing.
Right. This group that I mentioned earlier, the advocacy group, is really was meant to bring all these people together, and then what that group also does is it opines on what are the higher priority areas that we should be focused on, and there's a lot of discussion. The group got very large; it got to like 35 people across the company, and so we actually split it up into a sort of a hierarchy of groups. But the idea is that there are high priority opportunities for us that we definitely have to be plugged into. But there is also enough bandwidth with this new enablement model that, you know, we can actually address some of these non-high priority use cases just to really allow us to get some bedrock out there in terms of proliferating and democratizing ML. But certainly the high pri items get discussed and they are triaged. And, you know, it's no longer someone in the Center for Machine Learning saying, I think this is the highest priority. Mm-hmm. This is coming from the business now. And that's a flip on mm-hmm. on how we operated a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like kind of putting some of the pieces together, transitioning the model to one where you don't necessarily own the development of the, you know, the model and getting it into production, but you're supporting the business as well as the, you know, platform and infrastructure pieces that you mentioned have created a, you know, velocity or acceleration or efficiency to being able to work on these projects that allows you to get, you know, more done in more areas.
Right. So there are, most of the models are owned by the owners of the use cases, so the lines of business, if you will, or even our tech partners, because we often partner with our tech partners for anomaly detection, let's say. So they own those use cases and they will typically own those models. There are some models that we own as well. Okay. And that we take, you know, that we'll start and take into production. But what we're trying to do really is to empower others to be to be self-sufficient and to be able to leverage these best practices, leverage the tools and tech that either are emerging or have been built, you know, so that we can do things in a very consistent, well-managed, and again, compliant way.
Can you give us a sense of scope for how many data scientists exist within Capital One relative to the number within the COE? Just trying to understand the kind of the leverage that you're trying to create with the COE. And maybe to just tack another question onto that, one of the things that, you know, I see a lot of in industry is the kind of shifting away from thinking of the data scientist as this kind of monolithic, you know, unicorn that can do everything from statistical analysis to production ready code. And you are starting to see a lot more of machine learning engineers as a separate and distinct role that works with the data scientist as part of the team and you know, brings more of a software engineering perspective. And I'm wondering how that plays out at Capital One.
So there are data scientists within the lines of business that have come up through the sort of traditional ranks of statistical analysis and data science. And there have been transformations in those skill sets, you know, to more toward understanding how to address this life cycle for machine learning. So the machine learning engineering part, if you will. Mm-hmm. We have worked very closely with our tech college organization to do a couple of things. One is to provide curriculum on how to round out a data scientist to understand what that whole spectrum looks like, and also a reskilling program that we have not officially launched yet. Sort of we developed all the content for, but to take data engineers or software engineers and to get them converted into machine learning engineers. So this reskilling program is all about that. Within the Center for Machine Learning, we do focus on bringing in machine learning engineers. So they will have a little software engineering, they will have data science, they will have DevOps, you know, the data engineering. And so they tend to cover all the entire life cycle of machine learning, if you will. But as you might expect, there isn't enough supply of those type of people. But we are seeing the lines of business actually hiring this type of talent, and then it becomes sort of viral. It's contagious, and they're able to, you know, to leverage that skill set and teach others, and you know, and get some critical mass around the MLE. We still call our machine learning engineers software engineers from an organizational perspective. It's just a kind of a legacy thing But we do have, what I would say is that the concentration of machine learning engineers within the Center for Machine Learning is probably at par with some of the largest lines of business that we have. Now, they certainly have many more business analysts, many more data scientists than we have. Mm-hmm. Because they have to. And as we begin to automate a lot of these processes involved in the machine learning lifecycle, these data scientists are going to be a lot more capable of doing much more than they have before, because if they don't know how to do a deployment, it's going to be push button. You know, if they don't know how to access a feature set, that's going to be a library call from a Python notebook. It's going to be fairly easy for them. And so part of our strategy for, you know, our platform, our ML ecosystem, is to really take a giant step, a step function, if you will, to make these data scientists a lot more capable, while we're also teaching them the rest of the, you know, all the other parts that encompass what you need to know for machine learning engineering.
Does your organization end up owning the ML ecosystem, the platform, and responsibility for its maintenance and upkeep and all that? Or are you more defining the requirements and partnering with a an IT or other technology organization to, you know, get it up and keep it up.
Now, we're an enterprise function, so that's part of the new identity we've taken on, is that we are going to own and support production systems, production machine learning systems. That is a new responsibility that has come into our organization, and we embrace that, and we look forward to dealing with that.
Yeah, going back to the platform you mentioned, the feature store, feature component, and I guess this is fresh on my mind because of a conversation I had yesterday, but when a data scientist or an ML engineer builds a feature and contributes it to a feature store type of environment, there's a certain level of responsibility now for that feature. It becomes kind of a mini product in a sense, and it limits them in the way they evolve it potentially. There may be an implied support requirement. Nothing necessarily specific to features, but anytime you're trying to take advantage of reuse, there's this implied contract that comes from kind of contributing your code or your feature. Is that an issue that you grapple with, and how does it play out at Capital One?
Yeah, that's actually a very very good point. And it's like, careful what you wish for, right? Because because there's always the flip side of something that you have to deal with. Anyone who contributes a feature to the feature platform has to understand the responsibility that goes with that. And there is a responsibility. There's a responsibility to be able to field questions on that feature. There's a responsibility to stand behind the engine that calculates that feature. There's a responsibility to have gone through the governance associated with that feature and the use cases that it serves. And so it's a much bigger deal. You can't just casually commit something back. You have to understand exactly what you're doing and where that accountability lies. The same thing is true with the platform. When we took that on, we had to understand that, you know, there may be calls at 2 o'clock in the morning associated with this platform. Center for Machine Learning has never had that before. Mm-hmm. And when we added talent to the Center for Machine Learning, we brought people in who had production experience, enterprise platform experience, because a lot of people there, you know, were machine learning engineers, some of them fresh out of school, some of them fresh out of their PhD programs. Not many really had that level of experience. So we had to retool, and we brought in a very large group to integrate into the Center for Machine Learning. But the mindset is that there is an operational accountability that we have, and that anyone is going to have who contributes features into the feature platform. Now, if you think about our data transformation, the same thing's true there. If you manufacture data, you're almost in the same position where you have to be able to, you know, you're going to put data into an ecosystem and make it available for someone else. And there has to be some level of accountability that goes with that. It just can't be something that you casually contribute. Mm-hmm. So this is all part of our well-managed initiative. And I think, you know, to scale machine learning across our organization to really transform banking, we understand that we're going to have to be more disciplined about how we conduct ourselves.
You mentioned something interesting in there. It sounded like you brought in an organization that had existing platform capability. Was this an internal transfer of a team?
It was. That's exactly what it was. There was a platform team that was in another group. And when I started to have these conversations with our executive management, we knew that we had to seed our talent with this other type of talent. Mm-hmm. And so we went and started to look at organizational adjustments, and we wound up integrating an entire group. And we actually did it in two waves. We brought in half the group, mm-hmm. and then we brought in the second half of the group after we had built up some critical mass. And so now what we've done is we actually have a platforms organization within the Center for Machine Learning that is all about enterprise-level, enterprise platforms. So we're talking about resilience, scalability,
right,
logging, you know, all the things that you'd expect to see with a platform. This team has the experience in actually doing all those things.
Yeah, it's a really great example of something that I talk to folks about all the time. You know, whereas machine learning and building out machine learning platforms might be new to an organization, the core kind of requirements and engineering practices probably aren't new. Capital One, for example, has, I've known Capital One for many years to be investing heavily in platform as a service and container orchestration and all kinds of, not to mention we're here at reInvent Cloud and building, platforms to support traditional enterprise applications. A lot of the principles that go into supporting, enterprise apps, web apps are similar to, some of the things you need to be thinking about when you're supporting machine learning and AI-based systems. Is that your experience as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. Spot on. It's definitely my experience.
One of the things that you've mentioned as kind of a common thread throughout the discussion is the interface with risk and governance. Can you talk a little bit about more about that process?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that we are actually in a very unique and interesting position at Capital One when it comes to the governance around machine learning. We have been living in a regulated world for many, many years, obviously, and with varying degrees of regulatory oversight, as I mentioned before, material models and immaterial models, the ones that don't have to go through such high levels of regulatory scrutiny. But we understand the process, and we understand all these little sort of phases and artifacts and responsibilities and the laws of making sure that at the end of the day we are compliant, with the regulatory frameworks that we have to navigate within today manually. So let me give you an example. When we create a model, a machine learning model, we have to go through a process to validate the outcomes and how this model has actually performed. And one of the approaches that we might take is to build what are called these surrogate validation models. And so we go in and handcraft these other models, and these other models either support the outcomes that the model is, that you're trying to get through governance, or they might refute it. They might show something that's a little bit different. And then you have to write all this stuff up in a document, and you have to get that document through, and you have to defend it, and so on and so forth.
Is the surrogate validation model, is that like a test suite, or is it?
You can think of it.
An
you can think of it as a
kind of model, or
yeah, you can think of it as that, right? But like for example, if you're doing a gradient boosted machine, you might have surrogate models that are logistic regression models, that are something that are types of models that we've been able to, linear models that we've been able to deal with for many, many years. And we can see how these two models behave with, against certain types of data sets that they're scoring. The opportunity for us is because we know this process so well, we can actually use ML for governing ML. We can use natural language processing for auto document generation. We can use auto ML to generate those surrogate models automatically, and then run them. And we can use interpret those documents on the other side. We can double click into the validation models and surface the supporting argument for those models. And if you think about it even beyond that, when you talk to these model risk officers, the wheels are turning in their heads. They see so many opportunities for doing some really cool things. Like one model risk officer said to me, I'd like to have this sort of surrogate recommendation engine that's saying, hey, I just picked up this bias in this data set, in your feature set. And here are the artifacts that I picked up. So this thing's running kind of at alongside you, and it's picking this kind of bias up and recommend you make these changes or you take a look at, these particular features. That's cool stuff. Mm-hmm. When you can actually do, if you could actually do something like that. So we're looking into piloting and doing some POCs around a lot of these kind of interesting, model governance kinds of tasks. Now, I don't think we'll ever take the human out of the loop, especially for those highly regulated use cases, but I think we're going to make their workload significantly less laborious. And if you think about the proliferation of machine learning models at Capital One, we don't want to just stack them up on the model risk officer's back door, and we're in the same boat we're in today. They just have a huge backlog that they have to work through. We want to give them the tools to actually get through this. And we want to be able to build that right into our platform. And I think that's where we are thinking about the ideas that we're thinking about are far beyond what others are. As they're looking at machine learning, you know, just based on the conversations that I've had with them and that I'm seeing in the trade rags, is that the highly regulated models are certainly going to undergo tremendous scrutiny. We know that. But there's this other class of models that they're starting to look at it as well. And they're saying, even though the regulatory frameworks don't cover that those models, they need to be explained and interpreted and bias detected, just like these other models. And I think the sentiment is going to be that all models have to go through this sort of scrutiny. And I think the tech companies are going to be facing the same thing.
So what kind of advice would you give them, companies that don't have the history of operating in a regulatory framework, but want to, you know, either see the writing on the wall, or they are internally motivated to use machine learning in a responsible way? How do they, you know, kind of bootstrap, you know, the internal frameworks to do so?
I mentioned earlier about the rate of innovation in the industry. There are some emerging companies that are providing some libraries for some types of bias detection. You know, so there's some basic functions that you can do today with libraries in Python. And then there's companies that are springing up weekly, it seems like, you know, that are that are addressing explainable and interpretable AI. And so I would say that to those companies that don't have the expertise, you know, to just get savvy about what's happening. And there's so much literature out there about this. And also, you know, if you're in the cloud with AWS does have some basic capability with Shapley values that you can use to help explain or interpret your models. So there's some fundamental pieces there that that I think people should at least become aware of. But it's certainly something you should not ignore, because I believe that this is going to be, in 5 years from now, this is going to be something that is expected of everything that we do with machine learning. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to be able to explain that model. And yeah, I think it's going to all be built in.
Well, Dave, thanks so much for taking the time to share what you're up to. It sounds like it continues to be an interesting run, and you're doing a lot of interesting things there at Capital One. I appreciate the opportunity to learn about it.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. To follow along with our reInvent series, visit twimmelai.com/reInvent2019. Thanks once again to Capital One for their sponsorship of this series. Be sure to check out capitalone.com/tech/explore to learn more about their ML and AI research. Thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.